Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's Thursday, the first week, August 28th. Going to finish up first chapter pretty quick and then move into chapter 2, which is chemistry. And I didn't mention this the first day of class, especially for those people that are adding the class. I recommend that you take a chemistry class, college-level chemistry class, before this one. And if you haven't, that's just the way it goes. But if you want to get the best grade possible, then that's a really good strategy. Every student that has taken that advice has thanked me. Right? No one has come back to say, oh, it was a waste of time. And sooner or later, you're going to have to take chemistry anyway. That's just to kind of give you an idea of how important the next chapter is going to be. It's going to be some chemistry. So we're going to do some chemistry in the next chapter. All right, so that's just a... And if it was up to me, I would make it a prerequisite for this class. That's how strongly I feel about it. So if this class is really hard for you and you don't have a chemistry background, then you might want to get some chemistry before you take this class. All right, so here's a schedule on the right-hand side. I want to turn some of these lights down and off. I like that. I like that. Oh, that's good. Unless it's too dark. Is that too dark for anybody? No. That sounds good. All right, so we're talking about all kinds of things last time, like the scientific method. Scientific method is this big, long, complicated process unless you work with it every day. So why do people put up with doing something that's complicated and long and drawn out? What does it give you? What's the purpose of the scientific method? Yeah, just think, reliable information, right? And like I said, your textbook is at the level of theory, it's not hypothesis, so that's reliable information that you have in the textbook. No matter how strange it sounds to you, it's reliable information. All right, then we talked about homeostasis, and what is one good way to think about homeostasis, especially with regard to your internal environment, parameters of your internal environment, like water balance, salt balance, blood pressure, heart rate, all that kind of stuff. How does homeostasis relate to all of those different parameters? It's a dynamic equilibrium. I heard that one. I like that. Dynamic equilibrium. I heard that. And I don't know, somebody else said something over here, but I didn't quite hear what it was. Dynamic equilibrium means that there is no parameter in your body that is absolutely constant, right? All these parameters are changing, but they change in such a way that and compensate for other changes in your body so that nothing has to change drastically. They're all just dancing around each other. There's nothing that's absolutely constant. And homeostasis works by what kind of mechanism? Okay, it's going to be a response loop, and there's two different kinds of response loops. There's negative feedback and positive feedback, and the one that mostly, right, 99.99% of the time keeps you in a healthy state is a negative feedback mechanism. Even though negative kind of has a bad connotation to it, negative feedback in control system theory is a good thing because for us it maintains homeostasis. All right, so a response loop always starts with a stimulus, and it always ends with a response. Yeah, and even when we looked at reflexes back in anatomy, we started with a stimulus. So if somebody's going to undergo a withdrawal reflex from something, okay, how does that reflex always start? Like if somebody poked you in the side. Stimulus, yeah, it always starts with a stimulus. And it's going to end with a response. What is the effector if somebody pokes you in the side and you move out of the way? Skeletal muscle. Yeah, so skeletal muscle is a really good effector. That's a voluntary effector. Right? So that just means that if you saw somebody coming with their index finger pointing at you and they finally poke you in the side, you can stop that reflex from happening, right? Because those are skeletal muscles. Skeletal muscles are under voluntary control. If we look at the I want to talk about that syllabus in just a second. If we look at this integration center, what good is this integration center? It has something embedded in it. What does it have embedded in it?
Central
the set point, which is the absolute normal value for a particular parameter. And what does the integration center do? It analyzes a whole bunch of information. That's why we call it integration center. It's gathering information from a lot of places. And then what does it do with that information? Yeah, it processes it, compares it to the set point, and then it does even one more thing. What does that integration center do? Yeah, it makes a decision on how to counteract that stimulus, right? To force it back down toward the set point. Yeah. Okay, so make sure you can pick out some things in each of these little divisions right here, like what is a stimulus? Maybe give yourself an example of a sensor. Know something about an afferent pathway in lab. We give you a couple afferent pathways. They're going to be mostly nervous system, right? Mostly nerves. And they're, what kind of nerves are these going to be? Afferent or efferent? Oh, it says right there. Ah, okay. It's a sensory pathway, which is afferent. Yeah. And then the decision is sent out via the motor pathway, right, to the effector organ that produces a response. All right, so we wrap that slide up pretty nice. Let's look at the syllabus. I usually start with the syllabus in the sense that I want to look at the schedule to see how we're doing in here. All right, so today is August 28th, and we're going to start chemistry chapter, and indeed we will, and we're going to finish chapter 1. And don't forget, on Monday, we don't meet on Mondays, but this Monday is a holiday, Labor Day. If you have a class on Monday, it doesn't meet. But next week, we have two sessions, and then the week after that, two sessions, week after that, two sessions, and then here is your first exam, week 5. Okay, in chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. All right, so just kind of tune up your life schedule so you're not caught by surprise by that exam. There are a couple of things that I just changed at Blackboard this morning. The quizzes somehow got loaded in so that you didn't see your answer for a particular question, so it was hard to understand when you took a quiz in there. What question you got right, which one you got wrong. So even if you went back a second time, it was hard to improve your score. All right, so I changed that around so that you do see what questions you got right, which ones you got wrong, and what answer you select. So you got a lot more information, so that will help you with that. At least for the first exam, I was able to get through all those quizzes. All right, okay, so that's good news. I have not fixed those links, however, for the internet study questions, right? But I'll try to get to that really, really soon. Okay, any questions on the timeline right here or the schedule? I think you guys are good with that. All right, so next slide. What the heck do we have on the next slide? Ah, good, I got my cursor back. Types of feedback. And as we said, there are two types of feedback, negative and positive, and which one maintains homeostasis? Negative feedback. And you should probably know why negative feedback. What's happening there that maintains homeostasis, the negative feedback, in terms of stimulus and response? Stimulus and response for negative feedback mechanism subtract from each other, right? That's why we call it negative feedback. If it's a positive feedback mechanism, then the response adds to the stimulus, and it drives you farther and farther away from the set point, producing a disease state. Okay, so that's basically what it says on these slides right here, with maybe just a couple more words in there. So the feedback mechanism that produces a compensated state is negative feedback, and positive feedback usually produces a disease state. There are a couple circumstances that we're going to look in here, some examples where positive feedback is normal and should happen. And because there's so few, they're noteworthy to know about. And maybe I'll just tell you, what should I tell you? I'll tell you about one, okay, and that is parturition. When somebody is being born, there's a special communication system between the fetus and the mother. So there are hormones that increase in the fetus, right, which then cause an increase in hormones, certain kind of hormones in the mother. Those hormones in the mother cause an increase in hormone secretion from the fetus, which causes an increased hormone secretion from the mother, and it keeps going like that and going like that forever and ever and ever. Okay, so that's positive feedback. What stops that positive feedback mechanism before somebody dies? Well, baby's born and everything is reset. Right. Another good example of a positive feedback mechanism would be nursing an infant, right? A milk letdown reflex, so that when an infant nurses on the breast, of course, the mother can feel that. There are nerves that go to the brain that release oxytocin, which goes to the breast, which releases more milk, okay? And what happens to the infant when there is milk on a breast? Do they get bored or... No, they start nursing more, right? That's a stimulating event for them that stimulates them to nurse more. So there's more tactile stimulation of the breast, which goes to the brain, which releases more oxytocin, and that stimulates the infant to nurse even more, which then causes an increase in oxytocin secretion. All right, so that's a nice positive feedback mechanism as well. So milk letdown reflex or nursing. Well, how come the whole universe isn't filled with breast milk? If it's a positive feedback mechanism, because it keeps going and going and going and going. And that's just because a breast only can produce a certain amount of milk, and that's it. And when the breast no longer can secrete milk, then the infant gets bored and falls asleep, right? And that resets the positive feedback mechanism. So something has to change kind of drastically, like parturition. Okay. All right, homeostasis, a couple of different kind of regulatory mechanisms. There's intrinsic control and extrinsic control. So here's a slide on intrinsic control. Intrinsic control is automatically built into the organ. And so the organ does not need an endocrine system, doesn't need to communicate with the nervous system to get information. It just knows what it should be doing and how it should adjust itself to meet the demands of the body. That is pretty nice. A good example of that is the Frank Starling Law of the Heart. And when we get to the heart, we're going to study this in detail, but the Frank Starling Law of the Heart just says, as blood is presented to the heart pumps more strongly. It gets stronger, which is a really nice thing. Right? So that's just intrinsic. It doesn't need any nerves or endocrine system. But it is a little unfortunate under certain circumstances. For instance, during hemorrhage, when somebody is losing a lot of blood, maybe due to laceration of an artery someplace in a car accident, which means that not the same amount of blood is returning to the heart. You're losing blood, right? It's running out on the pavement instead of your body. Right? That says that there's less blood going to the heart. So what does that mean for the heart? If more blood goes to the heart gets stronger. Less blood goes to the heart automatically gets weaker as a result of that, right? So that's an unfortunate circumstance. And, of course, that, of course, guides the way we want to treat somebody. Well, then we just give them fluids to get their blood back up, their blood volume back up to normal. And that strengthens their heart back to normal. Or give them blood products as well, either one of those things, right? So the heart can adjust its pumping function all by itself, does not need any kind of nervous system or endocrine system. Here is an example of extrinsic. The control comes from outside of the organ that is being regulated. Okay, so here we have thermoreceptors that are in the brain that monitor your body temperature. And this is what happens when you start to get cold, right? Those thermoreceptors compare the stimulus to the set point. And the brain can't really do anything to regulate its own temperature. It has to send information out through nervous system, for instance, to skeletal muscles to contract, which increases body temperature. And when it goes above normal, then sweat glands are activated by the nervous system. So this requires things outside of the brain, like sweat glands and muscles and nerves, to connect all of these things together. So this is an example of extrinsic control. And is this system that we're looking at right here, does this look like positive feedback or negative feedback? Oh, here's a nice question here. Is this positive or negative? And just by a really casual inspection, you can say this is negative feedback, but probably you should be able to discuss why. Why do you see this as negative feedback taking place? And as a matter of fact, I like your answer a lot. Why is this negative feedback? Because the parameter that we're looking at, which is temperature, is always forced back to the set point. If it goes below the set point, it's forced back to the set point. If it goes above the set point, it's forced back down. Right? If it was positive feedback, then these arrows would just point in one direction and get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Right? And if this is temperature, and if your body temperature were increasing, that means you would get hotter, which means then you would get hotter, which means then you would get hotter, and then you just explode into a ball of flames eventually. Okay. So that does not happen. Okay, here's an experiment that was done. And this was done on a normal person, not a diabetic. And diabetics have difficulty regulating blood glucose concentration. Glucose is an important metabolite in our body that we need, and it should be tightly regulated in our blood. It shouldn't go too high, shouldn't go too low, no matter if you're in a fed state or fasted state. So all night long, blood glucose should not drop very much, should not go up very much, but should stay pretty much constant. All right, so here is a graph of, whenever you look at a graph, what do you want to look at first? There's a technique. There's always something you should look at first when you see a graph to help you understand what it is. And it is, this is the first really important graph that we've looked at so far in this class. It is the axes. How are the axes labeled so you know what the different variables are? What are we comparing? So the vertical axis right here, we have glucose concentration, and I'm sure this is glucose concentration in the blood. It's not shown right here. Vertical is glucose concentration, and the horizontal axis is just time. So it is how blood glucose concentration changes over time. That's how we're going to read this graph. So always look at the axes first. And maybe you even want to look at the dimensions, the units of whatever we're looking at. Okay, so let's look at the first part of this graph, and that is, say, from minus 100 minutes all the way over to zero. Zero, something special is going to happen, so we're going to define that to be zero time. Before that time, we're going to give it a negative number. And what can you tell me about blood glucose concentration before zero? Okay. Yeah, I like that. It's pretty constant. It's dropping a little bit, but it's not varying radically, not compared to what else we see on this graph. All right, so at time zero, then, this volunteer was given an injection of insulin. And insulin is a passport signal that allows cells to take glucose up from the blood. And when cells take up glucose, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It goes down, right? So if glucose leaves the blood, goes into cells, then the concentration of glucose in the blood then has to go down. And that's the job of insulin. It's the passport signal that allows glucose to enter cells. Without insulin, glucose cannot enter cells. And all those cells then actually starve to death because glucose can't get into them. That's one of the consequences of diabetes. All right, so this person, a normal person, was injected with insulin, and all the cells in the body start to take up glucose. So there's a big drop in blood glucose concentration. All right, and then I'm not going to describe what happens in this part of the graph. So I want you to analyze that in your mind. And you should be able to tell me, is this a positive feedback mechanism that is operating on blood glucose concentration, or is it negative feedback? And tell me why. Okay, so here is the stimulus. The stimulus is a decrease in blood glucose concentration, and then what happens to that blood glucose concentration? It starts to go back to the set point. So is that positive feedback or negative feedback? Just by casual inspection. That's a nice negative feedback mechanism, right? So this is a nice normal circumstance, and that's what we want you to see on this slide. Okay. That here is a nice negative feedback mechanism because the parameter is always forced back toward the set point. And it's forced back to the set point via a couple of hormones. Insulin is one of them, but there's another one that works in opposition to insulin, and that is glucagon. All right, so insulin and glucagon come from an organ other than blood, so that's why we call that extrinsic control. Blood can't regulate itself. It needs the help of those hormones, those two hormones, insulin and glucagon, and there's some others too that we'll look at, but those are the two primary ones. Yeah.
You mentioned glucagon, and
Yes. And I think I have a slide in this chapter, so I'll go over that. So if it's an opposite effect, what I mean, insulin allows glucose to enter cells. Insulin decreases blood glucose concentration. Insulin also stimulates the uptake of glucose into the liver. Okay, and so glucose ends up in the liver and inside cells. Glucagon, on the other hand, increases blood glucose, right? So it has a tendency to stop cells from absorbing glucose, but it also goes to the liver and it tells the liver to secrete glucose into the blood. Okay, so that's why it has an opposite effect. All right, so, here are some lists. Here's a list of positive feedback, which is in a healthy state, normal state, and we got four of them right here. Talked about oxytocin, ovulation is another one, coagulation of blood is another one. Oh, an action potential that we're going to look at is even another one. Okay, so this is a nice list. So keep that list around so that when we talk about those things, you know, that's kind of a noteworthy process because it requires a positive feedback mechanism. Here is a slide that talks about blood pressure pretty much. And why does our body have blood pressure? We haven't even talked about that yet. So I just don't want to say blood pressure is important because you should have a sense of why it is important before we talk about it, to understand how important it is. Why do you have to have blood pressure in your body? Yeah. In order for blood to move around in your body, it's got to go from one area that's high pressure to another that's low pressure. Right, and so by your heart, that is very high blood pressure, and in an artery by your heart, that's very high blood pressure, and the tissues are lower pressure, so blood will flow from your heart to your tissues. Right? Without that pressure difference, then blood won't flow, and blood won't deliver oxygen and nutrients to those tissues, and so we need pressure for flow, blood flow. So here we have a person, and this is just an absolute normal person lying down, and all of a sudden he hears the alarm clock, and he jumps up, or maybe he rolls out of bed and stands up. And when that happens, right, there is a decrease in blood pressure, because right here in the body, all the pressure pretty much is the same, but when you stand up, there's lower pressure in the head, there's higher pressure down here in the legs, right? And since your brain is in your head, when it experiences a decrease in blood pressure, it experiences a decrease in flow, blood flow as well. So sometimes when somebody stands up, they might get a little dizzy, and they might even pass out because not enough blood is reaching their brain. Okay. So usually low blood pressure is very healthy. It protects your cardiovascular system. But if your blood pressure is so low that you pass out when you stand up, then that's not a good thing. Right, because then your head is going to hit the table and then bounce off the chair and then bounce off the floor. That's not a good thing. But usually low blood pressure is fantastic. All right, so what is the stimulus? The stimulus is a decrease in blood pressure when you change body position. And that just happens all the time. And if somebody is healthy and normal, then you're going to compensate for that sudden decrease in blood pressure. So decrease is the stimulus. And the stimulus then stimulates a sensor, right? So it's just a regular response loop that we're concerned with. There are blood pressure receptors, maybe in anatomy, you could remember where they're located. They're located in blood vessels, two particular locations. One is in the arch of the aorta, and then one is in the carotid sinus, right? Which is at the bifurcation of the common carotid into the internal and external carotid arteries in your neck. So those are the receptors, and those receptors are always sending signals to the vasomotor center in the medulla. It's sharing that information with the cardioregulatory center and the vasomotor center. And so there are nerves that do that. Vagus nerve sends in signals. Hypoglossal nerve sends those signals in. So those are the sensory nerves. The vasomotor center has that set point, knows what blood pressure should be, and when it starts to drop, it sends a decision out to the rest of the body to compensate for that initial stimulus. So here is one possible effector. This slide doesn't show all of them, but here is an effector of the heart. So what do you think the brain is telling the heart to do when blood pressure drops? Yeah, pump more vigorously, increase rate. So two things, force of contraction and the rate of contraction, and that will cause the blood pressure to increase. So what can you tell me about an increase in blood pressure compared? So increase in blood pressure is the response. The stimulus was a fall in blood pressure. So what kind of feedback loop is this? Obviously, it's a nice negative feedback because the response subtracts from the stimulus. And it even says right here. Okay, there are some other things that we're going to look at. But that describes pretty much everything on this slide in terms of blood pressure. So blood pressure in you when you stand up is going to decrease. Actually, I want to go back to this right here. Your blood pressure is going to increase, but as soon as you stand up, your heart is going to increase its rate and force of contraction, and your blood pressure then will be boosted back up and you won't pass out. This is a special reflex. This is a very special reflex. That's why I wanted to go back and talk about it. This kind of reflex maintains your blood pressure where it should be in the very short period of time. It's very fast. So this kind of mechanism will maintain your blood pressure from second to second, right? But not long term. If somebody has high blood pressure, this mechanism doesn't help them adjust their blood pressure at all. So long-term control is a different kind of reflex. This short-term control is what we call the baroreceptor reflex. You have slides of that in lab. Baroreceptor just says that there is a pressure sensor, so a barometer measures pressure, right? So baroreceptor is a pressure receptor involved in this reflex to maintain your blood pressure or to maintain homeostasis of your blood pressure very rapidly. It's a nervous reflex, nerve reflex. Doesn't include any hormones. All right, so baroreceptor reflex, you might want to write down right in there. All right, let's look in a little bit more detail in that control of blood glucose. And in terms of blood glucose, you can consider that your body is in one of two particular states. And the two particular states are what we call in a fed state. So this column right here should be fed state. That means that you have eaten something, right? This other column over here is what we call a fasting state. So this slide I would write a little bit differently. Fasting versus fed is usually how we talk about these two different conditions. Let's look at the fed state first. So what does that mean? Well, you've eaten something. So you have nutrients like glucose in your digestive tract. And through the normal process of digestion, that glucose enters the blood. You absorb that glucose from your digestive tract. And when you absorb glucose from your digestive tract, it goes into the blood. So what can you tell me about blood glucose concentration when you eat something? It goes up. That's right. And that's what we see right here. Blood glucose concentration increases. So what is that? Is that an effector? Is that an afferent pathway? No, it's a response. Is that a response? No, it's what? It's the stimulus. That's right, it's a stimulus. I'm trying to trick you guys. All right, so increased blood glucose is the stimulus. And so what do you have to have in order for your body to know that your blood glucose concentration is going up? Receptors. So those receptors are in the pancreas of all places, a special little place within the pancreas called the islets of Langerhans, and they can measure blood glucose. That's the integration center. And if your blood glucose concentration is going up, then it's going to make a decision to bring your blood glucose back down. And the way it does that is by secreting insulin. Right? Insulin is the passport that allows cells to take glucose up from the blood. Without that signal, glucose can't get into your cells. Your cells are kind of starving to death, even though there's plenty of glucose in your blood. It just can't get into cells. All right, so if that passport is issued, insulin is put into the blood, that will allow cells to take up glucose. All right, and when cells take glucose away from the blood, what happens to blood glucose concentration?
Down.
It goes down. And how? And what do we call that?
Response.
That's response. How does it relate to the stimulus? It subtracts. So does this maintain homeostasis? Yeah, because it's a nice negative feedback mechanism. We saw a graph of that just a couple slides ago. Let's look at this other condition. All right, so this is in a fasting state. You don't have glucose in your digestive tract, so your body cannot absorb glucose. Your blood cannot absorb glucose from your digestive tract. Right? So if it's not absorbing, you might think that your blood glucose is going to go down as a result of that. And without this mechanism, of course it would. All right, so when you're fasting, blood glucose does decrease a little bit. That's going to start this reflex. So decrease in blood glucose is what starts a reflex every time? A stimulus. All right, and again, there are receptors in the pancreas, islets of Langerhans. They're different cells, but they're all in the pancreas in these areas. All right, and the pancreas then is going to make a decision on what to do. It's going to decrease the secretion of insulin, which is what, opposite compared to when you're in a fed state. But it's also going to release another hormone called glucagon. Glucagon signals cellular uptake to slow down. So cells won't take as much glucose away from the blood, so that's going to have a tendency to maintain blood glucose concentration. It's also going to go to the liver and tell the liver, because it's a signaling compound, it's going to tell the liver to secrete glucose into the blood. All right, so what does the liver need? It's not on this slide, but you should probably know this. What does the liver have that allows it to see that there's a glucagon signal and allows it to change its physiology when this glucagon signal is present in the liver? What does the liver have to have? It's got to have a receptor for glucagon, right? Without that receptor, then this mechanism can't work. All right, so glucagon, as we see here, decreases uptake of glucose from the blood, which has a tendency to keep glucose high. It tells the liver to secrete glucose into the blood, and this response is going to be an increase in blood glucose concentration. And how does that relate to the initial stimulus? It subtracts, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, so what we have right here is nice antagonistic control. So when you hear that term antagonism, right, does it have a nice healthy connotation to you or kind of a shady pathological condition? Do you like to be around antagonistic people all the time? No, it has kind of a bad connotation to it. But in terms of control theory, antagonistic control is beautiful. It provides for precise control and balance, in this particular case, of blood glucose, because it's so important. Right, so antagonism means that there are two things, and they work in opposition to each other to help regulate. So let's think of a system where there is antagonism and what the good thing about this is. Well, you learned about this in anatomy because you know something about muscles. There are muscles that are antagonistic to each other. And what do they give you? They give you precise control and balance over your body, right? So tomorrow night when you're driving home and that person with the fancy blue uniform and the shiny badge and the sidearm over here pulls you over and says, I want you to take your fingertip and put it on your nose like this. Oh, I even close my eyes. That's great, right? So what are you employing? You could mouth off to the inspector or the policeman and say, oh, well, watch my finger. I have perfect antagonistic control over it, right? And you touch your nose, but you probably shouldn't say that because he doesn't know antagonism is good in this circumstance. So what is antagonistic? It is the biceps brachii, which causes flexion of the forearm, right? And if you didn't have antagonistic control, what would happen if you only had a biceps? Well, you could poke the officer in the eye, or you could poke yourself in the eye, right? Or even scratch your cheek really, really bad. But you have something better than that. You also have a triceps, right? They work in opposition to each other so that you have precise control and balance of your fingertip, right? So that's just a musculoskeletal example of antagonism and how important it is, right? In your automobile, you want to have nice, precise control and balance of your automobile, wouldn't you? Yeah, do you have an antagonistic mechanism there that allows you to have control of your vehicle? Brakes versus the gas pedal or accelerator. All right. So you knew about this principle a long time ago. If you only had an accelerator, sure, you could go someplace if you're really, really careful. Maybe after work you want to go home, you could drive home. But without a brake when you got home, what would you have to do? Well, just wave goodbye because you couldn't stop. Right, so antagonism is very important for parameters that are critical in the human body, and blood glucose concentration is one of them. So I hope you can see that insulin and glucagon work antagonistically to each other to maintain just a perfect blood glucose concentration in your body under normal circumstances. So antagonistic control is super important. As a matter of fact, you have a whole nervous system, a whole special nervous system that acts antagonistically to each other. I don't think I did that. Oh, I know what happened. Okay, never mind. I did do that. It's not the house lights. Okay, what nervous system is specifically designed to work through these principles of antagonism, to control things that you don't even have to think about because it does such a good job? Central nervous system, there's a better way, because your central nervous system is used to control skeletal muscles. Autonomic nervous system. Yeah, that's even better. That's more clear for me to see. Central nervous system, probably could come up with some really good examples, but a really good obvious example would be the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system, autonomic nervous system. Usually they are antagonistic to each other, not in all particular circumstances, but almost every single time. And if you make a clinical decision on what to do on the basis that sympathetic and parasympathetic is antagonistic to you, then I don't think you'll ever end up hurting anybody, because the exceptions to that rule are so rare. Okay, so that's so important. So you got a nice musculoskeletal example, you got a nice endocrine example, right? A real world example, and even a nervous system example of antagonism and how important they are. All right, so that's it for chapter one. And you might consider that the fun stuff, because what do we got to do now? You might think this is not so fun, but actually this is really fun. The chemistry chapter is important, because we're going to talk about some physical chemistry in here, and that really determines how our body functions, right? Because it has to obey all the same rules that all chemicals everywhere in the universe have to obey. Okay, so before we understand how these chemicals function in our body, what do you think we should learn about chemicals? Yeah, what they are. So we want to learn the anatomy of chemicals before we learn the physiology of chemicals, right? We always want to learn the anatomy. So I tell you what, if we change the anatomy of a chemical, what happens? We change the function of that chemical as well, right? Okay, so don't forget, anatomy is structure and physiology is function. Yeah. Okay. So here are some things we're going to look at in this chapter. Atoms, chemical bonds, what brings atoms together to form molecules. And sometimes a molecule is acidic. We're going to see what that means. Sometimes it's basic and it's measured with a scale, with a number called a pH scale. We'll look at that. You'll have to become familiar with that. That's real important. And it kind of works backwards compared to how you think it should work. And then we're going to look at some important, and you might want to cross this out, organic molecules. Cross organic out and put biological molecules. And it just so happens that most biological molecules are organic, but not in every particular case. And certainly not every organic molecule has a biological function. Most organic chemicals don't relate to life at all or are poisonous. Right, so we really want to think about important biological compounds in your body. And we can usually break these down into these four categories. Another name for a carbohydrate is a? Is carb, yeah. Or you could say it is a sugar. Okay, a lipid is a fat, protein, you know, things that muscles are made out of. They also make up enzymes. And nucleic acids. Anybody have a sense of what a nucleic acid is? It makes genetic material, right? So information can be stored in a nucleic acid. All your nuclei in your cells have nucleic acids in them that contain the blueprint on how to make your body. And if it's a blueprint on how to make your body, right, what else is it the blueprint for? How your body functions, right? How your body functions. So that genetic material determines the structure and also the function of your body, all stored in that information inside the nucleus. All right. Any questions so far? Any questions so far? I should have asked before we went out of chapter one, but any questions on chapter one? No. Okay, let's go to atoms. And we're going to use a nice model of an atom, It doesn't exactly exist like this in nature. We're going to use what we call the solar system model. We're going to look at a nucleus of an atom, which contains particles in the very, very center. And then we're going to look at things that, and the nucleus you could think of stationary, just being in one place. And then there are things outside of the nucleus that just kind of circle around it very, very rapidly. All right, and we can call these orbitals or shells. They're going to contain particles of a different kind. So you could think of this as being the sun in our solar system, and these particles that are moving around the sun are planets and other kinds of things. But in terms of chemistry, what we have in the nucleus could be one of three different kinds of thing, or one of two different kinds of things. There can be a proton in here or a neutron, and what we find in orbitals flying around the nucleus are electrons. So we've got three kinds of particles. We have neutrons and protons in the nucleus, and in these orbitals, or orbits, or shells, we have electrons. Okay, now the nice thing, the very important thing, is that a proton has an electrical charge associated with it. And we're all kind of familiar with electricity because we use electricity to power lights and all kinds of different things. I'm sure you're using electricity in your pocket right now, or your wrist, right, to power your watch or cell phone or something. And the proton inside the nucleus has a charge of 1, plus 1. So it's a plus charge, and it's absolutely 1. The electrons in orbitals have the exact opposite charge. They are negative, but exactly 1. So if we add a proton and an electron together, what do we get? So we get, okay, that's one way of thinking about it, but in terms of charge, they neutralize each other, right? We get absolutely zero charge. They neutralize each other. I have to think about if we actually add a neutron and a proton and an electron together, can we get a neutron? We might get something else too coming out of there. I'm not sure. Okay. So the charge on electrons and protons are exactly equal but opposite to each other. And when something has a charge, that's an unstable state. The stable state is zero charge. So what can you tell me about positive and negative charges? Do they ignore each other? Do they attract each other? Or do they repel each other?
They attract,
right? Because if we have one positive, one negative, they attract each other. And that becomes a very stable configuration when there's zero charge. All right, so I think we talked about this slide. Hydrogen has one proton inside the nucleus, so it has a charge of plus 1. And guess what? How many electrons does it have?
One.
Just 1. So minus 1 here, plus 1 here. The overall charge on a hydrogen atom is 0 when it's in this configuration. Here is another atom. This is carbon. And we have a lot of carbon inside our bodies. If we look at the nucleus, we're going to see 6 protons inside the nucleus. All right, but what can you tell me about like charges? Like charges, do they attract each other? No, they repel each other. So you're probably interested, well, how do we get all these 6 charges inside the nucleus without it blowing apart? Well, that's a little bit of a problem, and that's the reason why there are neutrons. They act kind of like little arbitrators, so that all these protons can fit in a small space without flying apart. Right? That's why all those neutrons are there. Right, but so there are 6 protons, so how many electrons would you like to see in orbitals around the nucleus? Yeah, so there's going to be 6. So if you count these electrons, indeed there are 6. So if there's 6 protons, 6 electrons, the carbon atom is neutral under this circumstance, has no electrical charge. The other thing that you see on this slide, okay, hydrogen, with this one electron, has just one orbital. But when we look at carbon, do you see one orbital or more? More. There are 2 of them, right? And here is just a law. The first orbital can only accept 2 electrons. You can only have 2 electrons in the first orbital. And in the second orbital, you can have as many as 8. But what about the second orbital for carbon? Does it have 8 electrons? No, it's only got 2. So 4 more electrons can be added to a carbon atom. And as a matter of fact, when you do that, when you fill up orbitals, that's when that atom becomes very stable. It's almost like being zero. Even though it's not electrical charge of zero, it's still very happy. Okay. All right, so that's carbon. The number of protons inside the nucleus determine what kind of element it is. So hydrogen is an element, carbon is an element. And can you give me maybe an example of another kind of element? Oxygen is an element. Okay, gold is an element, sodium. And we're going to look at the periodic table. We used to have a periodic table here, but it went away. We're going to use a periodic table to understand these different elements. And you're going to like that, actually, a whole lot. Okay, the atomic mass is the sum of all the protons and neutrons inside of an atom. Right, so these things do have a weight. They are added together. The atomic number is just the number of protons inside the nucleus. So the atomic number really defines what that particular element is. So for carbon, what is the atomic number? Yeah, it's 6. Right? And then the atomic mass would be 12, more or less 12. And on a periodic table, it would tell you all of that stuff. So you're going to have to learn how to read a periodic table so you don't have to memorize all of that stuff. The only thing that you have to memorize in terms of the periodic table, because the periodic table doesn't have the words spelled out in English, they're given abbreviations, they're given chemical symbols. So that's something that you do have to know. Right? And the chemical symbol for carbon is C. The chemical symbol for hydrogen is H, but sometimes it's not quite so straightforward as that. I do have a list of, here's a list of elements that you have to know because they're important in biological systems. All right, so here are the elements, oxygen, carbon, right, sulfur, chlorine, sodium, magnesium. Here is the chemical symbol for these things. Right, so if it was simple, like O for oxygen, C for carbon, then what would be the chemical symbol for sodium? It would be S, but it's not S, right? It is Na, capital A, capital N, little a. And that's because in Greek, the word for sodium is natrium. That's where it came from. So you don't have to know all that stuff, but at least you have to memorize this. All right, calcium is not C because carbon is C. Calcium is capital C, little a. Phosphorus is P. That's not so hard to understand. But potassium is another important element in our body. That can't be P because phosphorus is, so potassium is given the letter K. And in Greek, potassium is kalium, which starts with a K. So there is some rhyme or reason as to why they got these different symbols. Magnesium, capital M, little g. So your body is mostly made up of oxygen and hydrogen, and some carbon, not very much of all these other kinds of what we call major elements. You even have some trace elements in your body, which we can even hardly measure, right? But without them, you lose homeostasis and enter a disease state. These are chromium, cobalt, copper, iron, magnesium, or manganese, and magnesium. Oh, magnesium is up over here, right? And zinc. And you need a little bit of iodine as well. All right, so know the chemical symbols for these particular English words. All right, so this is an exam table. You don't have to know the percentage. I do want you to know the first two columns. It's okay with me if you don't know which one are major elements and trace elements, but I do want you to know the English name for these elements and their chemical symbols so that you can see them on the periodic table, so you can find them. And if you can find them on the periodic table, then the periodic table will tell you the atomic number of each one of these elements. That is what the number of protons inside the nucleus. And from what we've said so far, what about the atomic number of potassium and sulfur? Can they be the same? Can potassium and sulfur have the same atomic number? Nope, because that's the definition of what a different element is, right? So the atomic number changes what kind of element it is. And so that's changing the structure of that atom, which means what? It's going to change the function, how that atom functions in terms of chemistry. That's what we're interested here in this particular class. All right, so these electrons are in orbitals. The first shell gets 2, second shell can have up to 8. That's good for that. Valence electrons. These are the most important electrons. And these are the ones that are in the outermost shell, because these are the electrons that can participate in chemical reactions. So these are the ones that we're very interested. Oh, it says right here. All right, these are the ones we're very interested. So for carbon that I showed you, how many valence electrons does it have? Yeah, if you go back to that illustration of the carbon, it's got 4 valence electrons, even though it has 6 altogether. Isotopes, we're not really too concerned with isotopes in this class, but in medicine we're very interested because, for instance, if we look back at that carbon atom, we said that it has neutrons so that these protons don't fly outside the nucleus. If there's a compound that doesn't have enough neutrons, then protons will fly out of the nucleus and become what we call radioactive. So we use radioactivity to kill tumors, right, or to make pictures inside of people. So isotopes are important, but not in this class in particular. All right, so an isotope of an atom will have the exact same number of protons, but a different number of neutrons inside the nucleus. So the atomic number is going to be the same, but the atomic mass is going to be different. Okay, next topic, chemical bonds. In order for chemistry to take place, there has to be an interaction between two atoms, and the interaction is going to be through those valence electrons, the electrons that are in the outermost shell. Chemical reactions don't take place with things that are inside the nucleus. All right, so molecules are formed by chemical bonding between valence electrons of neighboring atoms. The number of bonds is determined by the number of electrons needed to complete the outermost shell. One bond, there's different kinds of bonds, and we've got to learn what the different kinds of bonds are. Here is one, a covalent bond. So here we have an atom with one proton inside the nucleus. So it's nothing circling here, that just represents one proton. And we have memorized that one proton defines the element hydrogen. It's going to be really easy to see when I can show you a periodic table. So here we have a hydrogen atom, has one proton. How many electrons does it have? Okay, a hydrogen atom only has one. Right, so that hydrogen atom is electrically neutral. They balance out. All right, so here we have a hydrogen atom, and here's one of the electrons for it. But what was the rule for this innermost shell? How many electrons can be placed in this shell to become very stable? It has 2. The first one is 2. Second one, 8. Third one, 8. All right, but the first one, only 2. So this hydrogen atom all by itself only has one electron, so it's going to look around the universe for another electron to fill up that outermost shell, right? What do we call the outermost shell once again? Valence. Yeah, the valence shell. Bumps into another hydrogen atom, okay, and how many electrons does another hydrogen atom have? It has 1. When they bump together, right, they can share these electrons. So sometimes both electrons are around this hydrogen atom, sometimes they're both around this one, and they both feel as if they have 2 electrons in their valence shell. So it's relatively stable. It's more stable than a hydrogen atom by itself. So this compound has a tendency to form. This is what we call a covalent bond. And you should know one key word to describe what a covalent bond is. It is sharing of electrons. So on this slide, put sharing of electrons, right? Sharing. This atom, the top atom, bottom atom, share these two to form a molecule. For instance, in hydrogen gas, it has 2 atoms. Oxygen gas that we're breathing, O2, has 2 atoms, and they share electrons. They form covalent bonds. Covalent bonds in biology are strong bonds. And as a matter of fact, in this class, we're going to learn them to be the strongest kind of chemical bond. There's other kinds of bonds that are much weaker, and we're going to look at those. Oh, and in particular, this one right here, okay, with these electrons forming a covalent bond, they're equally shared. Sometimes they're up over here. If they're up around the top atom for 1 minute, how long will they be down around the bottom atom? 1 minute, right? Exactly sharing equally. So we call this a nonpolar covalent bond because these electrons are shared equally between these two atoms. Here is an example of another kind of covalent bond, but these are what we call polar covalent bonds. And you know what? I think I want to build this molecule, so I need to stop class for a second and turn the light on, find a marker, all right, and I also want to find a periodic table. Where can I find a periodic table? It's in Blackboard someplace. So maybe I have to stop this projection right here. I don't have Blackboard open. Okay. Probably you should tell me to open up Blackboard all the time so I can get to those materials. All right, so while I'm typing, who's got some questions? Because this stuff might sound really weird to you guys, unless you've taken a chemistry class. Can't go log in. Okay, what is that? SSS, that's lowercase, nice. No questions? Okay, I'm looking, no questions. All right. Much better. Physiology. Let's see where I might have periodic table. Oh, you know what? I have one on the hard drive here. Never mind. Anybody see periodic table here? You see it? That's great. Up. Ah, periodic table. Fantastic. Okay, so I'll give you a periodic table for the test, or I'm going to hang one in the room, either way, like that. So let's pull that up. Pull it up. And let's see where it goes. Hopefully on the right-hand side. Okay, I'm for sure I double-clicked it this time. I was impatient. Did I hang the computer up? Maybe. Not responding. Okay, let's give it a second to respond. It's back. Good. So let me turn a couple lights on. All right, so let's put the periodic table here, and let's put that PowerPoint slide right here. All right, so let's build a water molecule with what you need. Where did it go? Ah, here it is. Okay, and maybe I can make it a little bit bigger. All right, so this is the periodic table that you get in chemistry class, exactly the same one. And I'm kind of amused that they give you this, because why am I kind of amused? There's something kind of terribly wrong with this. And this is what, the periodic table. It shouldn't be labeled atomic masses. There are atomic masses in here, but it should be labeled periodic table, right? Not really just atomic masses. So on this periodic table, I see H, which stands for hydrogen. Okay, I see C, that stands for carbon. I see Na, that stands for sodium, right? So you got to memorize that list. Right, and above each of these symbols, you see a number. And that number is called the atomic number. So how many protons does a hydrogen have?
One.
It tells you right here. Okay. And how many protons does iridium have? 77. Right? So you get that information just like that. How many protons does oxygen have? 8. So that's how that goes. So that's really handy. How many electrons are in the first orbital? This is something that you thought you had to memorize, but it tells you right on this chart. How many electrons go in the first orbital? 2. And that's what we see. If we look at a row, we see 1, 2 elements. Right. And then how many orbitals are in this? How many electrons in the second orbital?
8.
If it's completely filled up. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So that tells you what electrons are in which orbital, how many electrons are in each orbital. So that's what you want to use this periodic table for. On the test, I'll ask you, what's the atomic number, how many protons does magnesium have? You don't have to memorize that, right? What you have to memorize is that magnesium is Mg, and then you have to know how to read the periodic table to answer that question, and you'll have the periodic table. All right, does anybody feel confident in building a water molecule right now? What do we got? What are the two elements that make a water molecule? Hydrogen and oxygen. How many protons does hydrogen have? One. Okay, has one. Hydrogen has one. And oxygen has, because of the periodic table, it's got eight. All right, and a water molecule has what? Two hydrogens and one oxygen. That's why we call it H2O. So that little two represents that there's two of these things right here to make water. So let's start with oxygen. So oxygen has eight protons inside the nucleus, which means that it has how many electrons?
Eight,
right, to be neutral. How many in the first shell? One, two. How many in the second shell?
Eight.
No, six. We've got to subtract these two that are in the first shell right here, so we've got six. So we've got one, two, three, four, five, six. Oxygen all by itself is not terribly happy because in this valence shell right here, what is it looking for?
Two more
electrons. And it just so happens, how many electrons can a hydrogen donate or share?
One.
So if it shares one, how many hydrogens would have to share electrons with oxygen to fill up this shell, and it will also fill up the valence shell for hydrogen? Yeah, so two of them will just automatically fit together really nice. So here is that hydrogen. There's one proton in the nucleus. Here is that orbital, and it's got an electron. And then we got another hydrogen here, which is a proton in the nucleus. It's got this valence shell right here with an electron. So these two are shared, right? So what kind of bond is this where these electrons are being shared? That's covalent. And oh, look, here's another one. And this is another, what type of bond? Covalent bond. Okay. So these are strong bonds. But this is a little bit different because this oxygen atom likes to take these electrons away from hydrogen. It likes to keep them right in this area here. Right in this area right here. All right. So what's the charge up over here by this hydrogen atom? It's positive. Okay. What about over here? Positive. And then over in this region, we have a lot of electrons, right? So in this area, we're going to see a lot of negative charge in this area here. So depending, so if you look at this molecule from far away, it has neutral electrical charge. It doesn't have an electrical charge. But if you sneak up on this water molecule from this direction, what does it look like? It looks like it has a negative charge. If you sneak up on this molecule from this direction, it looks like it has a positive charge. So depending on what direction you look at this molecule, it might have some partial charge associated with it, even though it is electrically neutral. And because different ends of this molecule have different electrical characteristics, we call this a polar. Right? This is a polar compound. And these bonds are covalent. Yes, they're covalent, but they're polar covalent bonds. Furthermore, and that's the special property of oxygen. Okay, but there are some other atoms that do the same kind of thing. So there is oxygen. There is this one. There is this one. All right, so these are atoms. This is what we did. What's this? Phosphorus. This is sulfur. And there's one more. There's one more. You might have to look. Ah, nitrogen. Oh, thank you, thank you. Okay, nitrogen. These atoms form polar covalent bonds. And that's going to be really important to understand why your body functions a certain way, right? Because that determines the structure of these things. Okay, so water is a polar compound. Other polar compounds can dissolve in water. Nonpolar compounds cannot. All right, so like compounds will dissolve together, will attract each other. Dissimilar compounds in terms of polarity will not dissolve in each other. Here is an example of an atom that forms nonpolar covalent bonds. It's a property of this. What is this right here? This is a carbon atom. Right? So in your body, you have two different natures. You have a polar nature and a nonpolar nature, and we're going to see how that affects our physiology. All right, so could you build this water molecule by yourself sometime? Probably, not too difficult, as long as you had a periodic table, right? Because I'm not asking you to know that oxygen has eight protons inside the nucleus. All right, so I think that's all I want to know about this periodic table for the moment. So you might want to get a print out this periodic table that's in Blackboard. Circle the elements that you have to know, and then make sure you know what they're called. That might be a good way to do it so that you don't forget. Just go down that list that's in that PowerPoint slide. Okay. All right, so let's go back to here. Options. Okay, who's got a question so far? What kind of atoms form polar covalent bonds? Nitrogen,
oxygen,
phosphorus, and sulfur. Yeah. So compounds that have those elements like to associate themselves with water because water has oxygen. Okay. If it's a molecule that has only carbon atoms, then it doesn't like to associate with oxygen. And the interesting thing about that, you know that oils don't mix with water. And that's because water is polar and an oil contains mostly carbons, which are nonpolar. So those things don't like to mix together. Just to give you a quick background. Okay. And covalent bonds in this class are the strong kind of bonds. The next weakest kind of bond is an ionic bond. In some forms of chemistry, ionic bonds are very, very strong, but not in biology because these ions are surrounded by water. All right, so what's an ionic bond? Oh, you know what? I do want to use that periodic table. Fantastic. I'm glad I brought it up. Okay, sorry, you're going to have to look at both screens at the same time. So here we have an atom of sodium. How many protons does sodium have? So we're going to find it. We got to know sodium is Na. Here's Na. It's got 11 protons, which means how many electrons does it have? It's got 11, so let's fill up the orbitals. So here is 2, right? And here then is 8, so that is what, 10? There's one more electron, but it can't fit in the second orbital. It's got to go in the next orbital. So here's the valence orbital, and it only has a measly one electron. So in order for sodium to become stable, it has to gain 7 electrons or lose one. What's easier? Lose one is a lot easier, right? Okay, so sodium is just dying to give that electron away so that the valence shell, which then will be this one right here, is filled up with electrons. All right, well, what kind of atom is going to want one electron? It just so happens, chlorine. How many protons does chlorine have? Okay, chlorine. Where is chlorine? It's got 17. Wow, it's way beyond the fingers on my hand. Okay, we'll have to work with that. It's got 17, but let's build that molecule, that atom up. It's got 17 protons, so it's going to have 17 electrons. So we got 2 in the first shell, 8 in the second, which is 10. Okay, which means then there are 7 in the outermost shell, right here, but to become stable, what should it have? 8, not 7. So it's going to look around for an electron. Well, when these two things bump into each other, this electron switches over to the chlorine atom, right, and now sodium is stable and chlorine is stable, but because sodium now has lost an electron, there is an additional positive charge inside the nucleus. And so now this entity right here has one positive charge. No matter how you look at it, it's going to have a charge of plus 1. But the chlorine is not going to have a charge of plus 1. It's going to have a charge of negative 1. Okay, so these compounds are what we call ions.